Welcome to another episode of the Gonzo Chronicles. This is your host, Cyrus Alderwood. Thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. We've got a very special guest today. I've been very pleased to. I've been drumming her up on previous shows. We have Teresa St. Francis with us today. Teresa, how are you doing?
I'm doing awesome. I want to thank you for having me on the show, and I want to thank your listeners for listening. This is a very important topic. I've put my heart and soul into this. This is the vast majority of my career, is to help people understand suicide, as well as how spirit works and how spirit integrates with us, our angels, our family members, those in heaven, and why it's important for us to live the life that we love. So even though it's a suicide prevention book, it's also a book about living the life that you love.
And you have an incredible story yourself, and I kind of want to get into that. And I don't want to like spoil the whole book because I'll tell the readers why here in a minute, but I want to read the back from your book here, just so people know a little bit about you. Teresa St. Francis is an author, psychic medium, life coach, animal communicator, and lecturer. And you live with your kids, your pets there in New Jersey, and where you give private readings and workshops. And the more I've read this book, the more I've learned a little bit about your private readings. Let's kind of step back. Tell us a little bit about you, and then, you know, and kind of when you discovered the gift that you have.
Well, you know, I grew up in a very Catholic Italian family, and I was the outcast of the family. My mother always told me, never tell anybody what you see, what you hear. But I always, from the age of four, my grandfather had Duchess, his German Shepherd, who became our German Shepherd after he passed. And that's how I knew I was able to communicate with animals. And I always could see people around other people. We were at a 4th of July barbecue at about the same time. And my parents both come from very large families, both very large Italian families. And my parents are the youngest. So their children would have been the youngest out of all the grandchildren. So I'm sitting on my mom's lap. And for those of you who, I'll date myself, those of you who remember the old 8mm projector reels, and the screens outside, my parents, every time they would throw a 4th of July party, they put up the old screen and the reels, and they would all sit and watch. Well, they're sitting on my mom's lap, and I could see everybody, not on the screen, but also sitting with us and standing next to us. So I told my mom. She spun me around because I come from a very Catholic background. And she said to me, you can never tell anybody. We go to church and pray every day. That you shouldn't tell anybody. And then I started to tell her what I saw, what everybody's name was, what they did. They had a lot of films and reels from decades before I was even born, and in Italy, in America. So I couldn't have known all what I knew. That was the start. And then growing up, I watched I Dream a Genie, Casper the Friendly Ghost, The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, Bewitched. And I saw a lot of the things that were happening to me on TV. So I thought it happened to everybody.
So when you first noticed that at such a young age, no less, was that frightening at all to you?
No, because it's so familiar. It's just part of, and it's familiar for me today. When they go quiet, when everybody takes a break and they leave me alone for a little bit, I get antsy. I get a little squirrely because it's so unfamiliar to me. I've seen spirit. I've talked to spirit, loved ones, family, pets on the other side, talking to live animals here. My whole life, it's as if I breathe. If it doesn't happen, then I don't feel like I'm breathing.
Okay, because that was, you know, I found that very fascinating when I was learning a little bit about you in the beginning of your book. And then as, you know, you started off with a reading with a particular client of yours and who had a daughter named Michelle. Now, I've never met Michelle, but after reading your book, I will never forget Michelle. And I imagine it's probably a very powerful emotion for you when you think of Michelle. Before we kind of jump into that, I think people need to understand a couple of things about the book. Can you tell us what a life contract is? You brought this up in the book.
And I wrote extensively about it in the book. Life contract is something we've designed with our family, our friends, the Creator, that allows us to be integral in this life. And I don't want to give away too much of the book, but a life contract is just like a contract that you do here between two people, whether it's a business contract or a marriage contract. Same ideology, except your life contract is very detailed. And I go through the book and I explain those details.
Yeah, you do a great job in the book. And just to kind of, so the listener will understand a little bit about the book. I was so excited to talk to you about this book because it was such a powerful story. The way you wrote it was in a very conversational tone. It was almost like you would read a play. You know, this is what you're saying. This is what your client is saying. This is what their past loved one is saying. And it reminded me of a couple of things. And I'm not going to compare your book to others because it's really not a comparison. But sometimes when you read a book, it just sticks with you. I mean, I've read hundreds, thousands of books in my life. And I couldn't tell you, you know, more than like 10 that really had an impact on me. And like something like a Mitch Albom, who wrote Tuesdays with Maury, or First Phone Call from Heaven, books like that. The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. It was written very Q&A type, which kind of reminded me of the style you used. So this was your first book, right? Is this your only book?
It's my only book right now.
I will, from a guy I've written probably, I've got 10 books on Amazon, I've written 15. And I will say for your first book, just the style, the format, and the way you get your message across, kudos to you, because I know how hard it is to write a book, and to kind of write it in such a style on your first attempt to make it that powerful, awesome job. I will tell you that.
Well, I will thank my tag team for that. That's my teachers, angels, and guides. We all have them. We all have a tag team. That's my Enneagram for teachers, angels, and guides. They support us. They love us. They're our spiritual family. I speak about that in the book as well. It was through Michelle's coordination and my team that we wrote the book in unison. Without them, the book wouldn't have not been written.
You really explain how they're just as much a part of writing this book as you, and the stresses you went through during this, I think were particularly powerful, because I just can't imagine. Like, I always try to relate to people. There's no way I could possibly relate to the immense emotion and pressure and stress of what you went through writing this book, from, you know, any of the goofy stuff that I write. But you mentioned your tag team, and before we get into Michelle, that was another thing I wanted to kind of lay the groundwork for. Yeah, I guess it's 2021, and we live in an age for the last 15, 20 years. What most of us, the listeners, you know, shows like this, learn from or know about mediums and spirits and spirit guides, it's just the stuff we see on TV. And before that, from movies, you know, and it doesn't, I don't think from reading your book, it really, there's a huge disconnect from what reality is and what the garbage we see on TV that's supposedly reality is. And you mentioned your tag team because your work with your guides in such a unique way, it's different from anything I think any of us have seen on any of these shows. And can you explain how you work with your tag team? And do other mediums see it the same way and we just don't know this?
I can't speak for anybody else. I can only speak for myself. I work with my tag team. They are my partners in doing this, in doing the private sessions, the lectures, the workshops, the life coaching, writing the book, the readings, because it's their connection with me. I'm just a telephone. I just deliver the information as I get it, as I receive it, in the best way possible for my client, for the reader, so that it illuminates your consciousness. It illuminates an awareness that there's more to life. There's many more components to life other than the physical, that we are spiritual beings having a human reality. But let's not forget, without spirit, none of this gets coordinated. Synchronicity with the universe. And I have a very synchronistic relationship with my tag team because they provide me with my gifts. My gifts are not mine. They're from the Creator. They're part of me, but I need their connection to fulfill my life contract and fulfill what I have been brought here to do, which is to help humanity, heal the world, help people improve the quality of your life to thrive.
Okay, so yeah, that was kind of, you know, I guess I was a little confused based on, you know, reading this book. It just seemed like that's just the way it should be with that communication with your team. And from watching other things, like I didn't know, do all mediums have something very similar or not? Or I guess, you know, I mean, there's nothing new under the sun. Everything could be different and yet the same.
Right. Yeah. You have, there's a lot of mediums out there now popping up who don't have the qualifications or say they do. There seems to be a whole awakening along those lines. There's the professionals like myself. And then there's those waking up and not really seasoned on how to do this correctly. And you got Hollywood doing the sensational aspects of it, which is not really truthful. When you sit in front of me, when I do a reading, I don't know you, and I give you detailed information as presented in the book.
Yeah, and it's I think, well, I want to touch on the Hollywood aspect later on and the TV thing, but because I think that's doing a huge disservice. That's just my opinion. But
I agree.
I want to kind of step back. So now that we got those two things kind of laying the groundwork, a lady by the name Angela comes in for a reading, and this is where Michelle is introduced into the book. And I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on, like, that was life-changing for you, meeting Michelle, right? So did you have a sense from your tag team, your spirits, that this was coming, or was this just kind of out of the blue for you when you met Michelle?
It was really out of the blue. I'll give you the backstory to this. The backstory to the writing the book was, I was meeting my girlfriends for lunch, and I had done a reading with Angela. And I was so overwhelmed. I was exhausted. I was crying. I get to lunch with them, and I'm a disheveled mess. And the girls say to me, "What's going on with you? You know, we've not seen you this distraught." And my girlfriends have known me for quite a long time. And I proceed to tell them the story. And then my girlfriend says, "You need to write a book." And I'm like, "No, I don't want to write a book. I'm not an author. I'm not a good writer. I'm a great medium. I'm a great communicator. I'll talk to animals, dogs, people on the other side here." And they're like, "No, you got to write the book, because the epidemic of adolescent suicides is exponentially raising every year. And we know through our other friends, we've had our other friends' children commit suicide. So it's not like we don't know somebody. And every time we talk to somebody, somebody else knows somebody else who's committed suicide. So it's kind of like 6 degrees of separation. And because you have such a unique viewpoint and able to bring something to the table from this that nobody else can speak to or speak about." And the conversation over lunch went back and forth. We wound up having lunch for 4 hours.
Must have been a nice lunch.
I turned that to pre-dinner. I walked away, I got in the car, and there's Michelle in the car, and she starts talking, and one thing led to another that I also talk about in the book, on how she brought so many other spirits to my doorstep wanting to tell their story, and me feeling so overwhelmed, because how many people can I talk to, you know, and write them in the book? And I didn't want this book to be a huge book that people would look at and say, "It's too much to read." I wanted to be in a kind of a sweet spot of about 150 to 200 pages, where people would say, "Hey, I'm compelled. This is something I can read in a relatively short amount of time. I know we're all busy." So that's how a lot of it came about, was really spiritual assistance, my tag team, waking me up in the middle of the night. "You need to write this book. Leave me alone. I want to go to sleep." Not letting me sleep. Talking, chatter, up a storm. Chattering up a storm about writing the book. "Here, look at this." And I in the book, you read some of the stories of how some of the spirits actually got my attention, even in my private time and in my sanctuary.
Yeah, because your bedroom was off limits.
Yeah.
And then you would occasionally hear a pecking or what, you know, something getting your attention. And that was when I got, you know, such a heavy sense of how stressful it was, because not only you're just emotionally exhausted, but you have I don't know, for lack of a better way to say it, it's like drunken midgets around you all the time. They're all vying for attention. You know, everybody wants attention. You have to get their story and then like just get exhausted again. And at that point, I couldn't imagine how tiring that had to be. Now, for those who maybe I didn't mention this up front, but Angela is the mother and coming for the reading. Michelle is the daughter who committed suicide at college. And so Michelle's bringing all these people to you. How many times during the process of hearing their stories and like having your tag team just like constantly on you to do this, how many times did you just want to quit?
Almost every day. You know, I didn't know if the world wanted to hear it. I didn't know if I was doing the right thing by putting this out there. I questioned myself a lot. I questioned, you know, everybody who came. You know, it was a very difficult time for me. And I'm working professionally every day reading, doing my readings, and I'm writing at night. So I'm constantly inundated with spirit, constantly not getting any downtime. And the exhaustion at times was so overwhelming. I walked around my house like I was drunk. I couldn't put words into sentence. I would forget to eat. I forget to walk my kids. Writing the book sometimes, I would lose track of time. Sometimes I'd start 6 o'clock at night and I would be writing and writing till 6 in the morning and I would still write. There was one day I wrote 24 hours. And I started at 6 and I ended at 6 the very next day.
Wow.
At the same time at night. And I looked at my dogs and I'm like, oh my God, I didn't feed them. I haven't walked. At the time, I lost total track of time.
Well, you know you're in a zone when you write that long. I thought my writing binges were legendary. No, not at all now. And, you know, that being, you know, incredibly tiring, what was your tag team still kind of heavy pressure, or were they understanding during the period?
No, it was a lot of heavy pressure because there were so many people wanting to tell their stories. There were so many people who want to be acknowledged because they feel like since they didn't fulfill their life here, and I talk about that in the book, they want to fulfill their life on the other side, and I go into great detail on how that happens and why that happens. So not only was it a pressure from my tag team, but it was a pressure from those individuals who did commit suicide wanting to try to help others so they wouldn't do it because they regretted what they did.
And I don't want to give away the book, but you know what happens the day after messages from adolescent suicides, their experience in the afterlife is much different than everyone else's who dies naturally. And that was a very powerful message, I think, when you get to that point in reading that book, not just what it means to them in the hereafter, but their families and the ripple effects of pain left behind. And I think that was one of the powerful things about stories. I was just kind of blown away by not just the teen suicide aspect, but the reasons why. And you categorized them. I mean, Michelle helped categorize. Is that right? Okay. And that was I was just kind of blown away by the different reasons. And there were so many people that fell into each category. It was just mind blowing.
Oh, there was, and I didn't write about the others. I selectively, with my tag team, we sat down and selected stories that we figured would be the best impact. Because we wrote this book. I wanted to write this book with an impact of people walking away and thinking about this book days, weeks, months later. I didn't want to have this book be another shelf book. It's another book you read, put it on the shelf, and you forget about it. Because it's too important.
Yeah, the meaning behind it is, it is, like you said, it's too important. And trust me, people read this book are not going to forget it anytime soon. Something happened here in my little hometown about 3 years ago, and not directly related to my family, but my nephew, one of his best friends he played basketball with, I guess called in sick, didn't go to school one day. And I guess everybody was expecting him there later in the morning. And I guess he, for whatever reason, had enough of life and took a shotgun and shot himself once. And then I guess had the wherewithal when his mother was outside at the time and he was in the house and he'd shot himself. And it was it didn't do the job. He literally was able to pick the gun up and fire a second shot, because after his mother walked outside, he locked the door so she couldn't get back in. And that was a horrible, horrible thing. And there was all kinds of speculation about bullying and who was actually doing the bullying. Was it coming from school? Was it coming from home? And, you know, I don't want to get into any of that. There was some court, there were some legal issues that happened here with the families. And not long after that, another young, beautiful young girl who always, apparently I didn't know her, but my nephew knew her too, here in high school, same high school, you know, went outside and hung herself from a tree in the front yard.
It's a national epidemic. Not only just adolescent suicides, but suicide right now on every level is a national epidemic. When I wrote the book, it was more adolescent, but since COVID's been here and we've had a complete change in our society's policies and the inability to socialize and get out and social distancing, the epidemic of suicides in the last 12 to 18 months is mind-blowing, even to the point where you don't even hear about it anymore. You don't hear about anybody committing suicide because they don't want to put it on TV to make it a point of focus.
And we're all COVID blind because that is the only thing that's on there. You would think no one's dying of cancer or heart attacks or anything else. And you're right, during this pandemic, and you before we started recording, you said some very powerful things about that and about our loss of humanity because of the policies of this. And you're welcome to go into that. I'd love to, for our audience to hear your thoughts on that. But in Japan, I read that suicide is always bad in Japan anyway. It's always higher there than anywhere else, I guess because of societal pressures. But even they're shocked at the number of suicides that have happened in Japan since COVID and lockdowns and people – you can't have that human touch, that human communication. And there's only so much that social media or, you know, even like FaceTime or Zoom or Skype can do for us to embrace our humanity and the things that we need to be who we are. Can you expound on that a little bit? Because you got into this before we started recording, and I thought that was really important.
COVID's brought to the table a whole new way of life. And humans are designed to hug, to love, to integrate, to share, to hold each other, to kiss each other, to have human physical contact. Now that COVID has social distanced everybody and you're wearing masks and all of this has come about, it's created a huge social psychological barrier between life and living. And most people feel like they're just existing. And add to the fact that the powers that be, whether you want to call them government, politics, doctors, whoever, keep saying, you know, at least on the early insurgence of this was, it's not going to be too long. The fact that we're in it over a year has people burnt out and worn out and overwhelmed, and has been every month it gets worse. So we're in a point in society that we need to take back some of our humanity and start living life to the fullest. And in doing so, I give techniques in the book. I'll give one technique today, which is put your mask on, take a shower, put clean clothes on, have somebody else that you want to hug do the same thing, go meet and hug.
And it's crazy in this today's society how, like, we've seen acts of violence against people that weren't wearing a mask right or shook hands or hugged, and people in public just raising hell on these people. It's just, to me, I find that absolutely just asinine, bullying, and ridiculous. And you throw on the top of that that a lot of people through this pandemic have lost their businesses or lost their job, are behind on mortgage or rent, you know, and all these things come into play, and then they get a measly, you know, $1,200 check for their trouble. It's almost insulting on top of all that. You can see just how that desperation builds up, and it's such bad energy.
Well, I agree with you 100%. It's the powers that be, I don't want to get into great deal, that are putting out fear, anger, negativity, and it's no different than the air we breathe. I'm all about the energy. When you listen to my Facebook posts, I deal in energy. When I meet you for the first time, I see your soul. I'm also a medical empath. So when I see your soul, I get to see what you're about, how you resonate, how you vibrate, where how your organs are working, how much light you carry from the creator, how much wound you carry, well, how much your childhood plays out into your adulthood. Where's your pain? Where's your happiness? Where's your joy? All of my life, I've been able to see that. When I, even as a child, when I would meet new people, I would often make the comment, and my mother would be like, that's such a strange commenter. Why did you say that? And it, lo and behold, it was something either they were going to, thinking about, experiencing, feeling. I can see into the depth of your soul. I always have been. It doesn't matter to me what you're wearing, what color you are. I'm colorblind. I'm also fashion blind. I don't care what you're wearing. I don't care what nationality you are. I don't care what color your skin is. I look at your soul, and your soul has none of that. Soul doesn't care if you're thin or heavy, smart or less smart, funny, not funny, happy, not happy. Your soul tells me everything that's going on.
And, it, you know, it was sad, but it's also enlightening that some of these folks that you bring up in the book didn't know that, didn't realize any of that until after they had committed suicide.
Correct.
And
they looked upon, especially from an adolescent or somebody who's not matured or somebody so focused on a crisis or situation, whether it's money, health, career, family, that you get so ingrained into that belief structure, that focus, that you forget there's a whole world waiting for you, whether it's friends, whether it's family, whether it's work. Our lives were fulfilled from many different aspects. A lot of people, especially through COVID, and I talk about this in the book, get so laser focused that they forget to fulfill their lives and allow other people in to help them be fulfilled.
And I think another thing that just a thought that popped up as I was reading the book was that, you know, yeah, this, especially these generations, I mean, because you met people who had committed suicide for long ago. But with today's society and culture, I worry that a lot of young people, we have a society where everybody gets a trophy, you know, nobody fails. And then when hard times come upon them and challenges come upon them, they don't know how to handle. They literally don't know how to emotionally process these things. They don't understand that success in life is built on 1,000 failures. And it's a concept that they can't grasp. And I think that is just a dangerous thing that can actually lead to more teen suicide in this generation.
And I speak about that in an entire chapter in the book.
Mm-hmm.
About how we as a family, we as a society, need to reevaluate the messages we're sending to children. The messages of everybody is a winner. The messages of if you're not a winner, then you're worth nothing. That you have to be number one. I talk all about that in the book because those messages, like you said, life's built on 1,000 failures. One success doesn't allow you to learn anything. Life is about learning who you are and how you deal with the challenges, the experiences that come in your life. And we all have them. We all have good. We all have bad. The good we take for granted, and we express that enlightenment or that joy in the celebration of that moment. But it's just a moment. The real moments that last are the trials and tribulations, because it requires us to step into ourselves to figure out how we're going to handle a problem.
And a lot of times we discover who we are.
Correct.
And the strength that we don't think we have, but we do. Correct. Because we're tough people, but a lot of people just don't know it.
But a lot of people don't make their kids learn that. You have to learn how to go within. It's not an automatic self-discovery. You have to allow your children the time to see failure, to feel heartbreak. You have to do the tough love. Too many parents, in general, want to do the love, I call it,
mm-hmm.
which is everything is lovely, everything is good, I'm going to make your life completely easy. If there's a problem with school, I'm going to advocate for your school. You got a problem with the kid, I'm going to advocate for your kid. I'm going to make your lunch, I'm going to make your dinner, I'm going to do your clothes. I am not going to cause you to feel any discomfort. That is a problem.
Yeah, and you know, we don't grow. And
well, it's not only that we don't grow, we don't allow our children to find out that that's how they find out about themselves and the tools that the Creator gave them in order to succeed in their life. You don't know how to use the toolbox unless you start using the tools.
Exactly. And, you know, I worry about, we always, you know, people in our generation, we kind of always had this phrase, somebody went postal. You know, because, you know, if you're my age, if you're a Gen Xer, you know what that means. But I worry about young people who get their first job and get fired from their first job, how they handle that. Do they handle it with violence? Do they handle it with suicide?
I have a lot of clients who wind up owning their own businesses or are in the upper echelon of management that have to deal with the millennials and the Gen Xs. And there's a lot of that age group, the 20s, 30s, and early 40s, that have never really personally matured. And that personal maturity is what gives you the opportunity to go within to find out what's in your toolbox. Not everybody's got the same tools. You know, the way I'm going to handle a situation might be totally different than the way you're going to handle it. But guess what? You're going to handle it, and it's going to succeed because you're going to know who you are. You're going to know your soul. You're going to know the gifts that the Creator gave you in order to live your life. But if you haven't had the challenges to learn about you, the individual, the child, what are the tools that God gave me? What are the gifts that I can use to help me succeed in life? You won't succeed. It'll be constant lessons of learning that will look like failure, but it's not really failure. It's for you to go within to unlock your own inner journey. And I talk about the treasure chest in the book.
Yeah.
What's the treasure chest?
Yeah.
And I let the reader read that.
Yeah, and I wanted to, before we get to the next question I had, if somebody at this point is interested in contacting you for a reading or a consultation.
They can go to the website, which is teresastfrancis.com, which is teresastfrancis.com. And all my information, there's videos up, there's contact information, can be all found on my site.
And I'll link it up on my Facebook page, The Gonzo Chronicles, so people can click on it there. I wanted to ask your permission. There was, in the book, you gave some of the spirits an opportunity to speak, have their own platform. From Michelle, for example, from Dan. I was going to see if it would be okay if I just read this little piece from Dan.
Sure.
Okay. And this is from Dan. It's on page 182 of What Happens the Day After. I'm not a man of many words. If I could do it over, I would choose to come to heaven when I was supposed to, not by taking my own life far too early. I would come only when my contract was up and I was naturally going to arrive in heaven. Arriving in an unnatural way, as I did, is a horrible way to live in heaven. I see the difference, wayfarance, I'm probably butchering that, between naturally and unnaturally. It sucks being here unnaturally. It is too hard and too much work. I want to live like those who come naturally, as the life they lead is beautiful. I will not be able to live in beauty. It's like me saying that you can live in heaven in a beautiful house on the beach, sipping cocktails for the rest of your life, or you will haul trash for eternity. Which do you choose? Let me tell you, choose a natural arrival versus an untimely departure, Dan. And, you know, life is difficult. It reminded me of a quote I heard the other day after I read this. I thought of that. Life is difficult. You know, being married is hard. Being divorced is hard. Choose your hard. And just that all these obstacles are out there in life and nothing that comes easy. Choose your heart. You know, choose what you want to do.
I agree. And I there's a misperception in society. The misperception is that this life is really hard and I can leave it on my own choosing, at my own choice, and go to heaven and I'm relieved of my burdens. That could not be farther from the truth. because of the life contract and everything I wrote in the book and how we all interface with each other, how everything is intertwined, like a beautiful piece of fabric. That misconception that heaven is better than here when we go on our time versus a natural passing, the game is changed. It's an entirely different heaven.
It's so,
an entirely different life.
So what they're stuck in, what Dan was stuck in, what Michelle was stuck in, will they ever get out of it? And is that the equivalent of what is known as purgatory?
There's no purgatory per se, because they can still live in heaven, they can still live in the light, but they don't get to rest in peace. They have to coordinate everything else. And I talk extensively in the book and how all this, all these pieces are put together, and this becomes their paradigm until either the last person that they were supposed to impact passes or their life contract is fulfilled.
One thing I wanted to ask, you know, after I read all the, you know, the excerpts there at the end from like Dan and Michelle and those who others had specific messages, they had committed suicide for, you know, numerous people, different reasons, everything under the sun. And I was just kind of blown away by that. But I wanted to ask that someone who's reckless and knowing they're on a dangerous path and they OD on drugs or they purposely drink themselves to death, they know they're on that path, you know. Is that the same as suicide? Are they dealing with the same issue?
It's a similar issue. It's considered more of a natural passing, even though they had a hand in it. They didn't actually do the actual deed. The body shut down. It was the creator coming in. So it's not exactly suicide. It's, I call it passing, not natural passing, but passing by their own hand.
Okay.
In the sense of they took their own life into their own hands and lived a reckless life, whether it's drugs, alcohol, food, if you're a diabetic and you're just eating sugar and you're not listening to your doctors, that's not considered suicide. That's considered death by your own hand.
Okay. I thought of that movie Leaving Las Vegas with Nicolas Cage, and He knew he was going to Vegas to die. He was going to absolutely drink himself to death. And so I just thought, you know, there are people out there that are that reckless. They want to go, but whether they do it with pills or they do it with drugs and alcohol, it's just, you know. But either way, it's just terrible to be a terrible way to.
But there are consequences when you get to the other side. It's not like a natural passing. There's different categories of heaven. There's different categories and levels of light. And I talk about that in the book. It's not everything is equal.
So you mentioned, like, you know, Hollywood and the misconceptions earlier. I kind of wanted to get into that too, because there, I don't know how many ghost hunter shows they need to have on TV at one doggone time. And I understand these people are actors, and anything I see on TV, I assume is not true. But they give out a lot of misconceptions. Are there any of these shows that you see that are more likely true, or are all these things something we should not even be paying attention to?
Well, let's talk about the paranormal, ghost hunters, the paranormal hunters. I mean, I do vanquishing privately. I get rid of spirits in houses, but I get rid of them. I don't entertain them. I don't engage with them so they can continue living in that, in this multi-dimensional reality, number one. Number two, they go in to antagonize. They go in to incite.
Yeah.
They go in to make the volatile situation that's already bad worse.
Yeah.
And if you look at the, and I'm not going to say their names because I don't want to get sued, but, you know, there is a group of them on the Travel Channel that go in, and they pick specific places, family houses, people who are living in a house. They'll go in, they'll talk to the spirits. Then they come out and they say to the owners, oh, well, it's not too bad. You can live with it. Or, you know, it's not really animosity. Don't worry about it. You just went and antagonized a bunch of spirits. And then you left these families on the doorstep with spirits in their house.
Yeah, because, you know, in reading this book and now thinking of those shows, I can't look at those shows anywhere near the same, because the first, before, when people go, especially when they get with things that are demonic or whatever they're poking and prodding at, be careful what you look for or ask for, because you're going to get it eventually. And yeah, leaving those families behind with after they've poked and prodded and pissed off whatever's in the house, I started thinking after reading this book, what if that was Michelle or Dan or one of these spirits that have had all this pain and they go in and do something like that? How damn disrespectful.
Right. Let me ask you something. Let's reverse this for a quick second. Let's say we'll just use an example. And especially from the 1800s, early 1900s, there's a lot of haunted houses throughout this nation, especially in northern New Jersey, especially where there was George Washington, the Civil War, the Revolution, all of it. So you died in this house. This was your home. You're still there. You have other people move in. You think it's your home. You got these Ghostbusters coming in, telling you it's not your home, telling you, you know, what are you doing here, but not telling you how to leave, how to get to where you need to be, and just making it worse. Well, how would you feel? How would you feel if you were antagonized?
Oh, incensed. Yeah.
That's the problem. I will tell you, in my practice, I've had to take care of a lot of spirits, negative spirits, nefarious spirits, malevolent spirits that are being held onto by these Ghostbusters because they don't realize they're leaving with them.
There are paranormal groups popping up everywhere. Even in my neck of the woods, there's like 10 paranormal groups that go out just to stir the pot. How often do you have to go in and clean that mess up?
Well, if I'm called in, I'll do it if my tag team wants me to do it. But I also get clients who literally have ghosts that have attached to themselves to these paranormal investigators, wreaking havoc in their life, their marriages, their health, their relationships, their money. And these paranormal investigators don't even get a clue until after it happens. And once a spirit attaches to you like that, they're not letting go. You just can't say goodbye. You can't just say, excuse me, can you leave? Once they realize you're a host, you're their host. Guess what? You're the new feeding frenzy.
You can tell that with, I'm not saying any shows either, but you can see that with some of these people who have been doing this on TV for a long time, that were more, I guess, trying to incite the spirits and not just like get little proof of something knocking on the door or whatever. And then getting the hell out of there, you know. If I heard a knocking, I'd be running out of all ass anyway. But it's to me, it's very, disrespectful. But yeah, really dangerous. And you can see how a couple of personalities have become more sharp in just their attitude and actions, even on camera. And maybe that's an act. I don't know, but maybe not.
Also looked at too. Let's talk about. The paranormal's been on CBC for about 12 years. In the first 2 or 3 years, there was a group of men, and I want to name names, who were very active in tantalizing and agitating and tormenting spirits. I had one of them in my office, full of spirits. They were torturing him. He had divorced his wife, his family. It wrecked his whole life. The danger in that is so great. People don't even get it. People think it's a joke. It's only a joke until it happens to you. And then where do you turn?
And then he came to you to help. Yeah.
You only need little help. You need specialized help. You just can't go to a doctor. You just can't go to a hospital and say, hey, I'm having these issues. Can you remove this spirit?
That's amazing.
And all these groups, I'm a big advocate of telling all these groups to stop. You know, you think it's fun. You think it's something to do. You want to get on TV. This is going to bring your fame and fortune. At what cost? At what cost to you, your health, your family, your life? And those spirits. Those spirits talk to other spirits. Let me tell you. They all talk. They all go back on one of the levels of heaven. They all talk and they all coordinate. That's how spirits gang up on humans.
Again, be careful what you ask for because you'll get it. And that was another question I want to kind of bring up because just because of all the misconceptions and all these shows and, you know, television is tell a vision. And yeah, I don't take much of anything seriously, but some of these shows, these people seem either they're really good actors or they're just hell bent on finding things that they shouldn't be uncovering. And that, that is disturbing because they encourage a lot of the little local groups to pop up and do the same stupid things. And yeah, you're right. There's so many old places around here with old history that certainly doesn't appreciate the added attention. I mean, I guess if they're just looking to rest.
Well, there's a new show on TV. I don't remember exactly what it is, but they profile people who live in haunted houses and what has happened to them. And a lot of the haunted house investigators, Ghostbusters, or whatever the title you want to give them, their life gets much worse afterwards.
Wow.
Because you can't poke the bear and expect the bear not to respond.
Yeah, you're right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. There's like a little feedback here on my Audacity program here. It's like stalled.
Here.
All right. Yeah, my Audacity froze up is what that was. All right, hold on. I'm going to
pause. I will tell you. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, yeah.
Can you hear me now?
I can. Can you hear me?
I can hear you all broken. Do you want to stop it and run another Audacity?
Yeah, hold on just a second. I'm going to try to pause this.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, it said my Audacity was not responding for whatever reason, so it kind of froze up on me. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. You're all broken up.
Yeah, I'm not sure why it's doing that.
Every time I do an interview, every time I'm on TV, every time we try to video my events, everything electronics gets all wonky. It just feels with electronics all the time.
Oh, I hate that, but I can kind of understand how that would happen. I'll tell you what here. If you want us to kind of if you want us to kind of
I can't hear you.
All right, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a call, actually.
What?
I'll give you a phone call.
All right. Wait, you have my cell number?
I think it showed up.
I'm going to go to your office then.
Okay.
Let me get my phone. Yeah, you got my cell number?
I think so. It's somewhere here.
Here, I'll put it up on the message.
Oh, I got it here. I got it right here.
Thank you for calling the office.
I got it.
No, that's my office.
Okay.
No. Go look. Go to the direct message. Okay. There's my cell on the screen. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, yeah. Yeah, Audacity just kind of stopped responding. So I'm going to go ahead and like cut out of this Zoom chat.
Okay, okay.
And then I'll save what we have when Audacity like stops not responding. And I'll get that up. And but I thought it was a really that was a good interview, actually. I appreciate you doing that.
Oh, you're welcome. If you want me to come back anytime, please let me know. I'd love to talk about all kinds of stuff, about energy, how energy works, how spirit works in our lives.
Yeah, we'll definitely do that. I would love to have you back as a guest. Because there's so much stuff still yet to talk about. I think we just touched the tip of the iceberg.
We really have.
On so many things.
It's very common for light energy and spirit energy to spoil electronics. It's not uncommon.
Oh, that's...
When I'm working, things freeze, things, the batteries. You know, when I hire a video crew to video one of my events, literally... They'll start with slowly charged battery life, and within 5 or 10 minutes, everything's down to zero.
Wow. Yeah, that's going to make things hard.
Makes things very hard.
But yeah, once I get this up, I'll send you the link if you'll share it. And then when I do a follow-up podcast, I'll just kind of explain what happened with the audio.
Okay.
And then, we'll definitely do this again sometime. Okay. I wanted to ask you a quick question. I'm going to either go to use GoToMeeting or Zoom. Which do you think is better? I was going to use it like professionally, I guess, for my clients.
I like Zoom better. Zoom is easier, faster. I just found something called StreamYard recently. I'm looking into that because StreamYard, one of the things you can't do with Zoom is you can't stay on the screen and share your screen. So it's an either or. Follow me?
Oh, yeah, okay.
With StreamYard, I'm still looking into it, but with StreamYard, you can do a split screen. You, your client, and whatever you want to put up to show them.
Okay, yeah, that works. Okay.
So that works out better. So I'm actually looking possibly to migrate. I still have to look into it. I just touched the surface. But you can't do a split screen on Zoom, at least not right now. But you can do it on StreamYard. And I like the split screen.
Yeah, so many people use Zoom, though. That's kind of – but I do like having the ability for a split screen. I'm going to go get a new laptop because the one I use is so old right now that I wanted to get something – actually, pick me up here on audio again. All right. Since I got you on speaker here, I'll just – it started recording again. So we'll just kind of – just to kind of wrap up here, Teresa.
Uh-huh.
That I wanted to just thank you again for coming on the show. We did have audio issues because a lot of times the energy, like you say, when you talk, when you're doing readings or recordings, batteries get drained quickly. And every time you do a Zoom meeting, this ends up happening. Like audio gets scrambled and things like that. So that's nothing new to you. That was kind of new to me.
Not new to me. This is part of the course. This is my life every day. Because I carry such a large team with me of spirits, angels, teachers, and guides, my tag team, they interfere with the energetic components of human life.
Yeah. So I wanted to say, thanks again.
for doing the show. And people want to find you, they can go to Amazon.com and find the book. And I'd encourage you to pick it up. If you pick up the book, make sure you go back and leave a comment, a ranking, which I'll be doing soon. It's What Happens the Day After, Messages from Adolescent Suicides. And you have to come back on again because we have a ton of things to talk about.
Right, and I also can get from the website. So if you can't find it on Amazon, What Happens the Day After, Messages from Adolescent Suicides, there's a direct link on my website, TeresaSaintFrancis.com, that will send you right into Amazon.
Excellent. And if you don't mind, if I can dig up your address, I'll send this book up to you if you don't mind signing it, and I'll send an envelope to send it back in. And
I would love to do that.
I certainly appreciate it. And if you enjoy reading, I may toss one of my books in there for you, too.
I would love that. I look forward to speaking with you again and staying in touch with you. And I want to thank you again for having me and doing the work that you do. It's important that all of us work together to get messages out to help people thrive.
All right. Well, thanks so much. And we'll be in touch soon.
All right.
Bye-bye.